This is The First 50, a podcast celebrating the human stories behind the first 50 years of women's athletics at Princeton. Here are your hosts, Ford Family Director of Athletics, Molly Marcuse-Amon, and Jerry Price.
Hi, everyone. I'm Molly Marcuse-Amon, the Ford Family Director of Athletics at Princeton, and I'd like to welcome you to the first episode of The First 50, a podcast series to celebrate the first 50 years of women's athletics at Princeton and the women who built a model intercollegiate athletic program. This series is about the power of athletics in transforming lives and building leaders and building community. These will be the human stories behind our great women's athletic history. I'll be joined on these podcasts by Princeton's athletic historian, Jerry Price, who is also currently working on a book on the first 50 years of women's athletic history. Our podcast and Jerry's book are just a part of the great anniversary, which we had originally hoped would include many in-person celebrations, but will still be a phenomenal tribute to all of our great women athletes with speaker series events, social media content, and a ton of information on our webpage. So Jerry, welcome to our first podcast.
Thanks, Molly. This is pretty exciting for all of us in the athletic department at Princeton. I've done a lot of podcasts in the past, but this is something a little different. It's a huge thing, the 50th anniversary of women's athletics at Princeton. I can run down some of the great achievements that Princeton's had in women's athletics in the last 50 years. 211 Ivy League championships. So basically, since women came to Princeton, Princeton has won one-third of all women's Ivy League championships. There have been 22 individual national champions, 33 teams have won national championships, 35 Olympians have won 16 medals, there have been 4 Rhodes Scholars, there have been countless All-Americans and every other honor that you can find. There have been professional athletes and everything down the line. And in all, nearly 5,000 women have competed for Princeton in the first 50 years. And we are going to start our podcast series out with the two who started it all off. And when Merrilee Dean Baker was hired as the first women's athletic administrator at Princeton, she went into her office in Dillon Gym, and she found a phone and a folder. And in the folder was a 5-year plan for women's athletics at Princeton, and it called for intercollegiate competition in year 5. And what Merrilee has said is she took the folder and threw it out and sort of started down the path of building the program the way she wanted to. And she said a few weeks later, two young women walked into her office and asked if they could represent Princeton at the Eastern Intercollegiate Tennis Championships, which were going to be the following weekend in New Paltz, New York. Merrilee said, why not? And that event was October 17th, 1970, which is exactly 50 wow. years ago Saturday. And Molly, we are joined by the two women who started it all off.
I just have like a gigantic smile on my face because this is awesome. 50 years ago, it just exactly now this week. And we're just so thrilled to welcome these two unbelievable pioneering women. With us today are Margie Gangler-Smith, class of 1973, and Helena Novikova, class of 1972. We're going to hear a little bit about their very different paths to Princeton. We're going to hear about their experiences as I said, pioneering women and athletes. And we're going to hear about what this experience meant for them in their lives. We're going to keep it real to the degree we can, and we're going to have some fun. So welcome. So just to jump in, Margie, thanks so much for being with us today. You're a legend in our department still to this day, and I'm so excited to be talking with you. Take us back to that conversation with Merrilee Baker and how you pitched to her going to compete in that first competition.
Well, when I went to Princeton, when I decided to go there, and the other option was going to Stanford, one of the reasons I decided to go to Princeton was because of Jadwin Gymnasium. It had just been completed. And Eve Kraft, who ended up being the coach, and I knew her from just junior tennis days. I was never promised that there was going to be a team right away. It was more like there's going to be a facility now. There are going to be indoor courts. You're going to be able to practice. You can practice with the men if you want and go to tournaments. And so I wasn't really thinking of competing. I have a feeling it was probably my mother that had suggested that knew about the tournament and said, well, why didn't you go play?
It's always and, the mother, right? It's
yeah,
always-
well, and I have to give a lot of credit to my mother because she's really the one that got me involved in tennis and my 4 sisters and 2 brothers at a time when a lot of girls weren't playing tennis and they certainly weren't competing. It wasn't really the thing to do. So yeah, so Helen and I, we go up there, and I guess we went and got t-shirts at the U store, and someone sewed the name on the back. At some point, we had orange pom-poms. I'm not quite on our socks.
Yes, we did.
We did, yeah, because that was...
Black and orange.
Black and orange, but you know, you had the anklets then, and we had the pom-poms on it, and that was about it. And then we won, and I actually went back to read the results before this podcast, and I won like 6-love, 6-1, and I thought, I can't believe I won that easily.
Yeah, no, Jerry studied all of that. I think he
knows. Right. Yeah. Jerry, correct me if I'm wrong.
You actually won 6-love, 6-love.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Okay. But so that
you came in third in that event. How did you guys connect with each other to know that you were both tennis players, and sort of lead us up to that time that you walked into Dillon Gym to meet with Mara Lee? How, Helena, why don't you maybe tell us about that a little bit?
Well, when I came to Princeton, I was at all with an indoor facility, because back at home in Czechoslovakia, we had only one indoor facility for the entire country, and that was in Prague. And I was not from Prague, so I did not have much access to, you know, indoor facility during the winter season. So for me, having Jadwin Jin was phenomenal, and I must have bumped into Margie there. Mm-hmm. It was at the time after almost two years of not playing, because I was in transfer from Europe to the States, and during those maybe a year and a half, I had no opportunity to play tennis at all, because I lived in England and it was so rainy that balls would not bounce off the ground. It was always so damp. So, you know, for me, it was an opportunity to play, and I jumped at the chance to play, probably by hearing from Margie that this opportunity popped up.
So you guys just happened to meet each other either at Jadwin or out at the outdoor tennis courts, and you decided you'd go in together and pitch this idea. Is that right?
Most likely.
Yeah, I mean, Helena was a strong player. I mean, I remember your game. I mean, I was sort of very steady, and I just got the ball back, and you were definitely, she was much more aggressive. And I think we just both saw each other out on the courts. I think, Helena, you hit against the wall. Did you hit against the wall in Jadwin?
Yes. Okay. I did not know anybody.
Yeah.
I was always hitting against the wall. Yes.
And Jerry told me the story that you ran into somebody and another, maybe the university president or one, a professor at the Jadwin courts, and he convinced you to start playing a little more. Is that true?
Well, you know, that's another story. One day I was hitting against the wall by the tennis courts out by the pagoda. Mm-hmm. And somebody called out to me to say, listen, my partner is not here yet. Would you mind warming me up? So I did. And we had a good time. And then the partner showed up and I said goodbye. And the next time I saw him was when I went for an interview after I applied as a transfer student. He was the dean of student, and it was Mr. Bowen.
The old president, so you had a chance.
He was the one, you know, who I had been hitting the balls with, so, you know, accidentally or incidentally, and I did not know his name or anything until I came and met with him during the interview.
Awesome. Well, we're going to get into your stories as how you arrived at Princeton, but maybe just let's stay on that first event. So you convinced Mara Lee to let you play, and then talk to us about what that experience was like going to that tournament. How'd you get there? You know, did you sleep well the night before? Did you think about your nutrition? You know, what was on your mind?
I don't remember thinking about any of that stuff. It was just, you're going to a tournament, and I think when you're going through something, a lot of times you just don't realize the significance of it. And I certainly didn't. I've been playing tennis tournaments my whole life. And I guess I was expected to win, so I'm sure I was very nervous. I always hated being the top seed because everybody's out to get you. And to be honest, I didn't realize how significant it was until I made faces in the crowd in Sports Illustrated. And I just remember, because that's whenever I got Sports Illustrated or saw it, I'd always look for, okay, who's in faces in the crowd? And then when I saw I was in, I thought, wow, that really was a big deal.
And so what did the faces in the crowd say? It was just that you were the first?
It was the first time for a woman to represent Princeton. And she was victorious on the first try.
What do you think of that, though? So, I mean, you know, you walked into a university that had, you know, 100 and something year history of athletics, and now here you are, the first women to compete for Princeton. Is that even something that you thought about on the way up there, that you mentioned to each other, anything? Or it was just you had the opportunity to play a tennis tournament, and that's all you were focused on?
That's all I was focused on. Helena, what do you think?
Well, you know, the first couple of years in the United States, I was on cloud nine. I was really up there. I did not really know. I did not realize the significance at all. For me, co-education was not a big deal because I grew up in co-education. Mm. And so I didn't realize the historical significance really until my parade a couple of years ago during our 45th reunion, when we were carrying the flag of 1972, and the women classmates, not classmates, the women from the present day classes were jumping up, shaking mm-hmm. our hands. That's when I just shivers went down my arms, you know, goosebumps, when I realized the significance.
Yeah,
it was only then, not before, so much as presently.
Wow. And when you guys got back to campus after competing, was it a one-day tournament or a two-day tournament? Did anyone know you played in it? Did anyone ask you how you did? Or
we were in the Daily Princetonian. They wrote it up, you know, so, and it, you know, again, this, even at that time, it's still, more than a year before Title IX. And I think with being a female athlete at Princeton, still we were a bit of, you know, the guys didn't quite know how to react to us, and to see women playing tennis and playing well, and the fact that we were practicing with the men sometimes, and they saw that. And it was really neat, because I just remember thinking that everyone was pretty proud of us. And we got nothing but at least positive feedback. And personally for me and my family, my grandfather had been football player, class of 1913, and the Walter Camp All-American. And my father had gone.
Hobie Baker.
Oh, he was there with Hobie Baker, yes. And so I was aware of the Princeton athletic tradition. In fact, I have the scrapbook from my grandfather that I was looking at the other day. And he, in 1911, he was one of five guys that walked from Princeton to New Haven for the football game, for the Princeton-Yale football game. And I think that was a tradition to like just prove how much you wanted to be at a competition.
Oh my goodness.
And he was so proud. I think he was more excited about my win than I was. And just the fact that, again, it's this male alum, which a lot of people weren't so sure how the alumni were going to react to having women.
Right. And then to have you be so successful athletically, you got to see a lot of what people thought, I'm sure. I'm thrilled to hear that people were so proud of you guys, because what you did was really remarkable and set us off on a tremendous path of success and really transformation for many, many women. But I got a couple behind the scene questions for you guys. So did you guys play against each other all the time when you came back? Were you rivals? Did you try to beat each other up, or were you just great friends and good teammates and just loved it?
No, I don't think so. Margie, did you ever feel that way? We practiced with each other, but we also practiced with the other girls and the guys. It was, I don't think there was an inner competition so much. Margie was always better. So,
yeah, I don't remember having challenge matches or anything like that. And thank goodness, I probably would have been really, really nervous. Probably because I had a ranking coming in. You know, I was number one in the East for the women or whatever. So I think it was probably easy to put me up there. And plus, though, nobody else on the team competed and had rankings. I mean, Helena, you didn't have a ranking because you hadn't been playing. And everybody else basically came from, they had either played in their high school or at their club or something. So I was sort of the only legitimate player.
So when you guys came back, did you have another group of women who were on your team? Or when did the team actually form and how did it form? Maybe Helena.
I wonder if it was Eve Kraft that maybe started some, questioning if there's anybody else who would like to join the team. But I think it came together quite quickly. We had more people. Lori Watson joined. She was my roommate. Yes.
So, yeah, I think they put an ad in the Daily Princetonian and like 12 people showed up.
It
was a big team. When you look at the picture, I don't know how many there were all together. Mm-hmm. Jerry, you probably know the answer to that.
There were 15 on the team in the spring.
And, you know, we had a big following. It was so neat because the courts then were where Whitman College is now. And it would be nothing to have 100 people out there, mostly all guys, watching us practice and play our matches.
Did they get rowdy, or you know, were they respectful tennis fans?
Maybe a little rowdy, but not nothing too bad. But they were proud of us, which is
kind nice.
Of
rowdy, yes, yes.
Good. I love it. But before we transition a little bit more, your stories are both so incredible, and so we'd love to hear again. Jerry has written at length about it, but maybe a little bit about what brought you to Princeton in this sort of very unusual time for women, obviously, just when Princeton just started coeducation. And so maybe, Helena, talk to us a little bit. Your path is really quite remarkable, and tell us how you wound up at Princeton. I know it's a really long story, but maybe the highlights of that.
I feel a little bit badly saying that I happened to be in Princeton. So I thought, well, since I'm in Princeton and I would like to finish college, I'll apply here, because at that point I didn't realize the powerful image that Princeton University had. And I feel very, very lucky that me daring to walk into the registrar office asking whether I could apply there, that I had the nerve to do that. But it was more my ignorance than anything else. Maybe if I had known that what the name and the image of Princeton University, maybe I would not have had the nerve to go and apply, you know. So I feel very fortunate that not knowing was actually a bliss for me. And I walked in, I asked if I could apply as a transfer student, because I decided not to go back to Czechoslovakia, and I finished 3 years of college there. So that was the reason why I applied in Princeton, because I was in town.
So why were you in town? Can you tell us a little bit about what sort of brought you to Princeton?
Yeah, maybe talk a little bit about the path that took you from Czechoslovakia to Princeton.
So I left 5 days after the invasion of Czechoslovakia by the Warsaw Pact armies. And it so happened that two Princeton students were stuck in my hometown during the invasion and during the time when all the Russian tanks were all over the place. They were stuck in my hometown, and my family gave them shelter. So by that time, I had left, and they looked me up in Germany. And we exchanged telephone numbers, addresses, and we kept in touch. So when I came to the United States, originally just for 3 months, the first people who I wanted to visit were the two students who invited me to come to Princeton, because they wanted to show me their university town. Obviously, they were very proud of it. And they wanted to introduce me to Professor Billington, who they started a student-initiated seminar on Eastern European affairs of 1968, upon their return from Europe that year. And so that's how it happened that I came to Princeton, met the Billingtons, got familiar with Princeton University. And when I decided to stay and not go back to Czechoslovakia at that time, I was offered to live with the Billingtons and stayed in Princeton.
Wow. And so you were all by yourself here, and as a young woman, and yes, not alone?
I came with my $18 and 2 tennis rackets.
Wow.
Dunlop Maxwell.
That is incredible. You had $18 and 2 tennis rackets. That's what you brought with you?
That's what I had.
And look what you produced from those 2 tennis rackets. 50 years later, 30, just a tremendous amount of women loving athletics and benefiting from athletics. So that's a remarkable story. How much had you played tennis in Czechoslovakia before you started traveling? Obviously, you said you hadn't played for a couple of years, but how much did you play as a young girl in Czechoslovakia?
I started when I was about, I would say, 7 years old or so, but it was a seasonal sport. In Czechoslovakia, we did not have the indoor facilities, so I skied in the winter, I played tennis in the summer, and in between seasons, I swam, all competitively. And it really complemented each other. It kept me in shape, in physical shape, and I enjoyed the seasons, because by the end of one season, I looked forward to the start of the next season of a different sport.
Yeah.
So that's how I grew up. I grew up in a family of everybody being athletic. Our mother started with us all kinds of sports. I started out with figure skating, believe it or not, and ballet. And then gradually skiing and tennis and others.
Awesome. Well, that's an unbelievable story. We're going to come back to some of the things that you learned and the grit and power and passion that you learned by playing sports at a young age to allow you to really be so independent and make this big move in your life. It's really quite remarkable. But Margie, tell us about your path to Princeton, because again, you talked about it a little bit. You had a different sort of relationship with Princeton, but your own unique path to get here.
It's a lot more boring. I've 6 siblings and 5 girls and 2 boys. All the girls play tennis. And I was just lucky that my mother put us in the tennis clinic at the local, at our club that we grew up near. And then I played junior tournaments. And where I lived, basically, you go to boarding school. So it was either I go to a New England boarding school where I wouldn't have the opportunity to work in my tennis. And at that time, in like the 12 and unders and the 14s and the 16s, I was probably top 5 in the nation. So I was a good junior player. And then my parents found this school in La Jolla, the Bishop School, which was a boarding school, but it was excellent academically. And at that time, most of the junior players were either in California or Florida. So I went out there and loved it. All 4 of my sisters also went there. And then came time to college, and I had my heart set on Stanford. And I'll never forget, we had senior ditch day, where even though it was in La Jolla, California, we rarely went to the beach. But for senior ditch day, we got to go to the beach. And I'm out there, I've got the reflectors, I've got the baby oil, because, you know, it's near the end of school year. I want to go home with a tan and all this. And I come back and I get the thin letter from Stanford saying I've been rejected. I cried so hard, and I had the salt, my tears and the sunburn, that I was in the infirmary for 2 days. but things, you know.
Their loss was our gain.
Pardon me?
Their loss was our gain.
Well, and so then I went to Tulane. for a year, but Stanford had said, if you have a certain grade point average, you can transfer. So I basically went to Tulane. I did well. I applied. And when I applied to Stanford then as a transfer, my dad had said, well, you know, Princeton's gone co-ed. And why don't you think of applying there? And I had never thought of Princeton again because there weren't facilities there. And Jadwin changed the whole picture. And all of a sudden I thought, well, I was ready to come back on the East Coast because I grew up in New York. And one of the best decisions I made.
Awesome. And so isn't that, you know, again, the facility really made you think about how you could continue doing what you loved. I mean, you
exactly.
Love tennis. I mean, did you keep playing at Tulane or did you keep playing on?
Yeah, I played at Tulane and we had a strong team. I don't know, maybe we were top 10 in the nation, something like that. But the chance though, the opportunity to go to Princeton was just something I couldn't turn down. And it was great because I could do everything there. I mean, the indoor courts were great. I mean, there was great competition. And so it was everything I wanted.
And then awesome. You ended up on the cover of the Alumni Weekly.
Actually, the whole tennis career, whatever, at Princeton, the two times major that I thought, okay, well, I have done something sort of important was the faces in the crowd. But then when my picture was on the Alumni Weekly, but they also, though, they labeled me Princeton's best athlete, which I wasn't Princeton's best athlete, but I think I guess I was the face of women's tennis.
So that's what the headline said on the cover of the pop?
Yes, it said, goes Princeton's best. I mean, my grandfather, I mean, when he saw that, you know, he just said his friends would just roll over in their grave. You know, the fact to be a woman and then, you know, and I got the white letter sweater and the racket and it did, it went Princeton's best athlete. And then I did feel like a celebrity walking around campus. Then.
Did people recognize you? Did they?
I mean, I was...
Did you guys talk at all about your past and about how you arrived at Princeton? And did you know Helena's story, or was it just that she was another student that you met and a great pal and a teammate and didn't know anything about kind of what had happened?
I'm embarrassed to say I knew very, very little. Sorry.
Well, I didn't know that much about you either, you know, well, about your background. I knew your family. But not beyond your parents. I did not know that story. Mm-hmm.
Helen, do you look back on that and say, wow, how did I do that? How did I, and both of you really, again, we talked a little bit about perspective and not really knowing the impact you were having and how important and significant that first tennis match was. But do you look back, either of you, and say, wow, like that, now with some perspective, I might not have done that, or I might not have had the nerve to do that. And any advice that you have to our young women listening about that?
When I look back at my life, probably now I wonder how did I have the nerve to do a few things. But when you're young, you don't think about tomorrow. You just grab the opportunity, and the opportunities were there. For me, it was so exciting that the 11 years that I could not go back home flew by incredibly fast. So I did not even have too much time to be homesick. Of course, at Christmas time I was, but altogether, so much was happening that before I knew it, I was back at home. And after 11 years going home, nothing had changed there. Even prices were still the same.
Wow.
Whether it was the trip from my hometown to Prague or a piece of bread, it was still the same. The year later, it all jumped, you know, multifold. But for those 11 years, nothing had changed. So
you mentioned that for 11 years, you didn't go back, but it wasn't necessarily your choice not to go back. There were some other issues at play.
Oh, it was not my choice. I was tried in absentia because before I applied to Princeton, I received a letter from the government that my exit permit expired. and they gave me another about 30 days to return and told me that if I don't, it would be against paragraph such and such, and I would be tried in absentia. So those were the very difficult 30 days for me to decide. And once I decided, that's when I went to the registrar office to apply as a transfer student. And what happened back at home was that I was indeed tried in absentia. And it was very embarrassing for the people who were reading the verdict, because those had been my father's colleagues. My father had passed away before I left. And those colleagues were so embarrassed reading that, because my mother and my brothers were in the audience. I was sentenced to 18 months for overstaying my exit permit. So I had to wait until the amnesty, and the amnesty, I believe, was based on Helsinki Conference. Once the amnesty took place, it took another 2 to 3 years before my passport could be renewed. And that's why it took until 1979 when I could go back. Wow. And I did.
That's incredible. And just to both of you, maybe start with Margie, you know, how do you think your athletic interest and passion sort of shaped your personality and your willingness to try new things? And I mean, you sound like, Margie, you played your whole life, and you said before we got on the actual podcast, you said you loved playing sports and your whole family played sports. Do you think that shaped your personality and gave you that confidence to be able to walk into Merrill Lee Baker's office and ask to go play?
Oh, definitely. I mean, playing a sport, no matter what it is and no matter what level, but as long as you try to be the best you can be, I think just develops character. And in our family, my parents never made a big deal out of any of our accomplishments in tennis. So when you sort of say, you know, how did I react to winning that first tournament or doing something, I just played because I wanted to play and I do my best. And I kind of think it kept me from getting a big head or whatever, because my parents, you know, would say, okay, that's fine. And then there'd be something else that you do, but they're always very, very supportive.
It sounded like your parents are very encouraging. They saw the value in athletics, but it also
encouraging. And the discipline that you learn. And that's why I'm just in awe of the of Princeton's athletes now, because they're juggling so many more balls than I did when I was there. When I read about, you know, what they're studying and what they're doing and how they're volunteering, it's so much more than what I did.
How many hours did you guys train? Did you, you know, how many times a week did you play tennis?
We play every day, but just for a couple of hours. Did we ever do any weights? I mean, maybe you would jump rope. That might be it. And plus, people on our team could all do other sports. I mean, you look at my sister Louise. You know, she played field hockey and ice hockey at the same time, all 4 years. And you know, you didn't have to be so dedicated. Was that?
I was on the swim team, so
yeah,
I
that's
swam
right.
in the morning.
You swam in the mornings and played tennis in the afternoons.
Yep.
Awesome.
Talk a little bit about, you've both told me the story, but talk about, you know, we talked about performance now at Princeton, but talk about nutrition and your nutritional, what passed for nutrition on your trip to and from New Paltz?
Junk.
It was KFC for dinner and Dunkin' Donut for breakfast. I know.
Yeah. I mean, you didn't know that much about nutrition then.
No.
And, it's changed.
It didn't change that much. I mean, I think that there's some moments in time, and throughout this podcast, we're going to be talking to different women in different eras and sort of talking about that evolution of the, as we call them today, the performance behaviors, you know, sleep and nutrition and hydration and training load and recovery. In my day, I graduated in 1991, you know, we weren't talking about those things then either, you know, so a few years later after you, I mean, I used to go to the Wawa on the way to a game, and I shouldn't admit this, but I would get some nachos with cheese and have a little bit and hide it in the stick room maybe. And, you know, we stopped at McDonald's on the way to either not maybe right before a game, but on the way to a road trip, we'd stop at McDonald's or Wendy's, and that's where we would eat. Our teens would never do that now. I mean, their meals are planned out. The students are very focused on making sure that they're eating exactly the right things, both pre-meal, post-meal, very different. But, you know, it's fun to look back at KFC and Dunkin' Donuts, right?
Right. And when we were playing a match, we have salt tablets.
Yes.
Yeah. You take the water and salt. Nobody do that now.
No.
But right. I do. I started doing it again because at my age, I get terrible cramps. And, you know, I take electrolytes, but they don't do the magic that the salt pills did. Awesome. I tell you, I went back to salt pills now.
Wait, so speaking of present day, do you guys still play tennis now?
I do.
I don't.
Did either of you play? Margie, how often do you play now? And I mean,
right now I'm playing once a week. And actually yesterday I was playing. And I was so proud of myself. I was playing singles. I felt really good. So I tried for a ball I shouldn't have. And so anyway, I tweaked my back. So uh-oh. I'm not going to play the next couple of weeks.
Helen, are you still doing the Dragon Boats?
So I played tennis, you know, all those years. And I coached all those years, my varsity boys and girls varsity teams. I played competitively until a couple of years ago, but my elbow now is so bad that it's no longer enjoyable. So I don't play tennis, but I do dragon boat, and I love it.
What's a dragon boat?
I do dragon boat. I made the Team USA, so I went to the Worlds a couple of years ago and really enjoy it. And I even think that I missed my sport. In tennis, I was not strong mentally. I don't think that in competition, I did my, I performed at the highest level possible for myself. Whereas in dragon boating, I tell you, I get that adrenaline going, and I can get more than 100% out of myself on the course. I enjoy it.
Can you tell us what dragon boating is?
You just have a huge canoe with a dragon head up front and dragon tail in the back. It goes back to China and the Philippines, you know. That's where they used to have these boats, and they still do. Even larger than here. Here, the boat sits 20 people. It has 10 seats, one person sitting on the left, one on the right. And you have to paddle in sync. The distances are from 250 meters to 500 to 1,000 to 2,000. Wow. I like the long distances, but, you know, I enjoy them all.
That's incredible. So you feel like you have a better head for dragon boating than you did for tennis?
Definitely. Definitely, yes.
How about you?
I'm going to stick to tennis. Yeah.
How's your mental game? I mean, when you were an athlete and now, were you able to? I find tennis to be an incredibly difficult mental sport because I just started playing tennis much later in life than you all did, but I love it. And I find myself in practice being able to really hit the ball nicely. And then we start playing a match and it doesn't really work out all that well for me. I think it's just so mental. How were you, Margie, as an athlete during your prime? And then actually now, do you still feel like you have the right mental approach to the game?
I always got really, really nervous. And, but yet my sister Louise, she always reminds me, she said, yeah, you got nervous, but you managed to win all the matches. So I guess I overcame the nerves. But honestly, sometimes I go to tournaments and I would just pray for rain because I would just be too scared to play, especially if I was seated number one. I hated being seated number one. But I did win a lot of matches, so I guess I would overcome the nerves most of the time.
Nice. Awesome. Well, we have a couple more questions for you before we get to the end, because I could go on forever talking to you guys. This is so fun. But tell me a little bit about what you did after Princeton, and maybe we'll start with Helena. You know, what was your path, and just tell us a little bit about your life post Princeton.
Well, I went to Stanford. I finished my master's degree in education at Stanford, and met my husband there. He finished his PhD, and we decided to go into American Schools Overseas Education. And we left in 1975, went to Peru. That was the first place where we worked. Our daughter was born in Peru. Then we were in Nicaragua, Spain, Kenya. Our son was born in Kenya. Then we were in Kuwait, Puerto Rico, Venezuela, and the Philippines. And in all those schools, I was a teacher and also a varsity team coach, including softball. I coached softball in Peru. I coached tennis as well as swimming. Enjoyed it all, loved it. We were both outdoor people. So we did a lot of backpacking, whether it was in the Andes or Kilimanjaro, or wherever, we did a lot of backpacking.
Wow, that's awesome. And what about you, Margie?
So I graduated in 73 and then 74 got married and married Stan Smith, a professional tennis player. So I joined the men's tour. And I traveled around on the circuit. We had four kids. And I always thought, well, once we have four kids, he won't be traveling so much, but he still was traveling a lot. So I homeschooled. So I did 13 years of homeschooling with the kids, which I loved every minute. And all four of them actually played college tennis. So sort of proud of that. And then we live in Hilton Head, and pre-COVID, I volunteered at the Boys and Girls Club. I tutor over there most days that I'm home. One interesting thing that happened when we were traveling around the world before we had kids, in 1977, Stan was playing in South Africa. So this is during the height of apartheid, and there's a boy from the township there, Alexandra, sleeping on a dirt floor, aspiring tennis player that we happened to befriend. He was hanging out at the matches. Long story short, we ended up bringing him over to the United States and putting him through college. I think he went to four different colleges, went through the whole transfer stuff for different reasons, but we always believed in him and a good kid. He gets married. We graduated and became a writer, and he wrote the book Kaffir Boy about growing up in Alexandria.
Wow.
Had three children. All of them went to Princeton. The oldest one, Bianca Mathavani, class of 2011, a track star at Princeton. The older then Nathan, I think 2013, he was on his track team. And then the third child, Stanley, was a musician, and they all went to Princeton.
Now, doesn't Nathan work at Princeton now?
Yes, Nathan's here now.
So Nathan, you know, he works with us. And
he works with you with the athletes, yeah.
Yes, and he is incredible.
It's an incredible family. I don't know if you knew that story or not, but
I did not, and that is remarkable. Nathan is one of my favorites, and he just does a phenomenal job for us in the admissions office. So that's a great story. So how many years did you travel with Stan on the tour?
Well, sometimes I feel like we're still doing it. He's traveling 6 months of the year, and I travel about 3 months of the year. But we've been on Hilton Head. Well, I don't know. I don't know when we started spending more. I started spending more time here than away. Right now, we're into the grandparenting. So we're about on Friday, we're going to have our 16th. So I'm going to go up to New York, actually. And
16th grandchild?
16th.
Wow. Well,
yeah.
I have to ask the question that everybody wants to know. When did the shoe come out?
The shoe.
Who this shoe named after him that everybody knows? I mean, I use Stan Smith all the time.
We laugh because he is more of a celebrity now, and our kids think he's so cool because he's doing all this stuff with either it's with Pharrell or Jay-Z or whatever. But it's the 50th anniversary of the shoe next year, with his name on it. Yeah, the 50th. It was a French shoe, first leather shoe. It had a Frenchman's name on it. But Adidas wanted to get into the American market, and Stan happened to be number one in the US and the world then. So for a while, they had two names on the shoe, and then they just put Stan's name and the picture. But I mean, we laugh because honestly, he's more famous as a shoe now.
Most people don't have a shoe named after him that endures for 50 years.
Yeah, and I mean, last year when I started traveling, we literally went around the world on a book tour. And and I think supposedly they want to do something for the 50th celebration next year.
Wow, incredible. Well, both of you are really, truly remarkable, and this has been so incredibly fun. We have one last question that's really important to us that we're going to be asking all of our guests. What do you think, and we'll have each of you answer, what do you think the biggest value of sports for girls, young girls and women, what's the biggest value that you see in women and girls participating in sports? And maybe I'll start with you, Helena.
Well, you know, I saw it particularly when we lived in Kuwait. We lived in Kuwait during the time when girls were not allowed to do even physical education because they were not supposed to sweat. And I actually went a little bit out of my way to really be there for the Kuwaiti female teachers to go on encouraging and getting permissions for the girls to start participation, even if it was with the long sleeves, long leotards, and so on, at least the movement. I feel not only that it's number one healthy, not only for the body, but also for the mind. And in addition, I think socially, it also brings them out to be with people who they may not normally meet in their family life or other social life. In the athletic arena, they meet other people and develop other friendships, other opportunities that are there for them.
Yeah, awesome. Like the two of you. Coming from very different backgrounds and just going and dominating the tennis world while you were young women. That's incredible. How about you, Margie? I mean, you obviously, your family is deeply ingrained in sports, but what's your so what with all this?
I mean, what comes to mind is just the physical and mental health is so important. And the fact it's something you can set goals with whatever area you're involved in and to whatever degree, and it's something you can work for and to attain. And I think that that's just really important. And I just want to scream at people, just get off your phones and get out there and participate and work hard at something and just enjoy it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it seems like it helped develop you two into both incredible women who have done amazing things in your lives since that first competition in 1970. We're just grateful. All of us are grateful for you walking into Merrilee Baker's office and making this happen. So thank you both. Jerry, do you want to end with anything else? This has just been so fun.
No, this has been great. I really appreciate you guys taking the time to be with us. Like we said in the beginning, this is the first of our series of podcasts, and it's going to be a long celebration of women's athletics at Princeton, and the 50th anniversary, obviously, is Saturday, October 17th, and it started with you two, and it's been great to start this series with you. I really appreciate both of you taking the time to be with us, and like Molly said, it was a lot of fun.
And come and see us very soon.
I will. I look forward to the series.
Yes, and thank you for inviting us.
Yes, thank you.
Good to see you, Margie.
Okay, bye.
For Helena Novikova and for Margie Gangler-Smith and for Molly Marcus-Simon, I'm Jerry Price. Thank you for being with us here on our first podcast. And as we said, we look forward to bringing you the rest of the series. Again, thank you for your support of Princeton Athletics.
You've been listening to The First 50, a podcast celebrating the human stories behind the first 50 years of women's athletics at Princeton. We invite you to visit goprincetontigers.com/50years to submit your favorite memories and for more great content. including photos, feature stories, book excerpts, and the complete First 50 podcast series.